This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, so Helen, the last time I saw you was when you brought out Not Without a Fight.
Mm.
And I remember talking to you then about something I'm going to address again with you, because I just don't know where you get this energy, where you get this vigor to take on everybody on Twitter. My God, you reply to almost everyone. And you, even the morons, it's just amazing. You're far
like
more
the
of a,
morons.
But you're more of a Democrat than I could ever be, because I have dismissed those people as rubbish, and you actually take the trouble to reply to them, even if they're obviously and comprehensively stupid.
You know, I can't explain myself either, quite frankly.
Do you think it's a pathology?
I probably is, you know. I mean, my poor mother trying to raise me, you know, I still feel guilty looking back. You know, I'd never slept. I was ran around all over. I never accepted no for an answer. My poor mother really did battle with me. I mean, we remained very close all our lives after that. But, you know, I think I was really, really tough. And it's just who I am, Gareth. It's not something I try to be.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are kind of taken aback, particularly people who are your political opponents or maybe your ideological opponents,
yeah,
by the fact that you just do not back down. They're used to declaring a moral victory.
Hmm.
A lot of people do this on social media, even people who are not political. They find a way of getting the moral high ground, and then they feel that that's the end of the battle. And
hmm,
somehow you just keep, like the phoenix, coming back at them.
Well, you see, people think that if they call you a racist,
yeah, that's the end.
If they call you some pejorative term, they've won. Because immediately they're on the moral high ground, and who wants to listen to the comments or the opinions of a racist anyway?
Mm-hmm.
So they think that if they just throw in a nice pejorative word into the conversation, that's the end of it. And of course, for me, that isn't the end of it at all, because they haven't addressed the argument and they haven't addressed the issue. And I don't allow people to take the sneaky, easy way out by throwing around insults. So I believe I have to bring things back to the issue. And, of course, they run away or whine or retreat to wokeness, which is the instant guarantee of a ticket to the moral high ground and status amongst your progressive peers. And I don't go for that fake tactic.
Well, someone said the other day, and I wish I could give them credit for this, but that anyone who isn't a leftist is a racist, according to the left. But actually, it's anyone who isn't to the left of you that's a racist.
Absolutely.
And that's how the left views this stuff.
Absolutely. All the labels. They love the labels. Alt-right is another label. I don't even know what it means.
Are you alt-right, according to them?
I have absolutely no idea. I know what I am. I'm a classical liberal. I believe in the primacy of each individual to shape and to choose their life circumstances and to have the opportunities to do so. And I strongly believe that every individual has the right to choose who to associate with and to create groups of their choice to advance their interests. I also believe in the fallibility of individuals and that the state should enable people to change their minds and to have independent institutions to measure things against the social compact that we agree on in a constitution. Those are the things I believe in. If that makes me conservative, so be it. If it makes it me radical, so be it. The National Party used to call me a communist. These new woke heads refer to me as alt-right or racist. I'm exactly the same person, and I don't care about labels.
Have you changed your mind about anything really major in the last couple of years? I mean, particularly in light of, you know, having fights with people on Twitter, have you ever heard a really good argument against your position?
Well, I've never heard a good argument against free speech.
Yeah.
Even if people say something completely objectionable, it is our duty to defend their right to do so, unless it is hate speech. Now, hate speech is very specifically defined in our Constitution, and very few things fall under the definition of hate speech. And I think even at times Julius Malema has been incorrectly convicted of hate speech. Kill the Boer is definitely hate speech because it is an incitement to violence,
yeah,
imminent violence,
mm-hmm,
which is part of the definition of hate speech. But saying something, even if it's totally objectionable, like, you know, she enjoyed it if she gets up, has breakfast in the morning and asks for taxi money to leave, that is disgustingly objectionable, but it's not hate speech.
No, absolutely.
So we do have to defend his right to say it.
Even some very clearly racist language may be particularly
offensive,
objectionable,
yeah,
and offensive, but isn't necessarily hate speech.
Quite right. You see, now the bottom line is that open societies defend the right of people to be totally objectionable and tell total nonsense, because that is how you preserve freedom.
And that's also the best way to fight that nonsense.
Of course, because you bring it out into the open and you can contest it. Now, the interesting thing about progress is that almost every major step of progress in the world has been made because somebody said something that was totally objectionable and completely outside of what was commonly accepted in the society at the time.
Right, like Galileo saying, for example, that the sun is in the center and the earth spins around that rather than the other way around.
He was sentenced to death for that.
Yeah, and had to recant.
Yeah, he had to say, sorry, I made a mistake, when he knew he hadn't.
And Martin Luther saying we should not, you know, your ancestors, fellow countrymen, who said we should not have Bibles only in Latin, and the ordinary people should understand, and they should all have a Bible, and they should
and
all be able
to. And the Pope isn't the intermediary between me and God.
Right. Outrageous at the time. I mean, he's lucky he made it.
He's bloody lucky.
And there are many others throughout human history who've been brave enough to say things that were unpopular and objectionable at the time.
And turned out to be right.
How do you think, because you have a long eye on history, and it's one of the reasons I like listening to you, and I do pay attention to, not as much on Twitter as I used to. I don't think it's a very pleasant place.
It's a ghastly place. Everyone peed in the pool, as Stephen Fry said.
Yeah, but I still go there occasionally, you know, if I need a little kick in the backside. So... how do you think history, with the long view, will look at this period in South African history, but particularly with reference and respect to your participation in it on social media? Do you think we'll laugh at this and say, how ridiculous, in 10, 20 years' time? Or do you think we'll look at it as some kind of shift, some kind of moment of change, some time where something happened?
Well, interestingly, I think both. I think we will look back and laugh at the absurdity of this incredible offense-taking culture, this offense archaeology with people digging around to find reasons to be offended, trawling Twitter and social media every day, searching for something that they might well pump up into some manufactured outrage, and descending like a pack of hounds on this wicked witch. You know, we haven't even got out of the age of witch hunts, genuine witch hunts, where people are trying to find the evil witch and then burn her at the stake. You know, we're still those kinds of primitive people, and Twitter brings it all out in us. Twitter brings it all out in us. So I think on the one hand, we'll laugh at it. On the other hand, I think it does represent a very serious shift of moral culture. And Gareth, you know, I read a lot of really good analysis, and there are guys called Manning and Campbell. I think it is Jason Manning and Bradley Campbell, or the other way around. Mm-hmm. They are two brilliant sociologists writing in America at the moment. And they say what we are seeing now is one of the most of the three fundamental shifts in moral culture that has happened in the last 400 years.
Wow.
It is extraordinarily fascinating to read their work. They say the first happened at the end, I think, of the 18th century and into the 19th century, where we switched from an honor culture to a dignity culture. Now, in brief, that means an honor culture is best summarized by the play Romeo and Juliet. Feuding families, were the males in those families responsible for defending their honor? They would challenge people to duels. No such
thing. Someone would die. This is still going on in the Middle East. Sometimes.
Well, it's still going on in the gang culture in the Western Cape.
Correct.
You know, you kill somebody from an opposing family and they kill some. These gangs are families and they
blood rivals.
Mm. That's an honor culture.
Right.
You touch my blood, I touch your blood. And somehow it operates completely outside of the rule of law. Now, the big switch for countries that could develop further happened in the late 18th, 19th century, where suddenly we shifted to a dignity culture where everybody was assumed to have inherent rights that the state had a responsibility to protect. And then you saw the emergence of things like viable...
Is this pre-Enlightenment?
No, it's post-Enlightenment.
So is this the...
this
the,
product of enlightenment.
That we are made in the image of God, that there is the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as put into the Declaration of Independence.
That big shift happened then.
Okay.
And then you had to have institutions of state that would defend that. And so you couldn't take the law into your own hands. If you were wronged and an inherent right was violated, there were institutions of state that looked after it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you had to have efficient, effective, capable, independent institutions of state to look after individual dignity.
Like the courts.
Yeah.
Right.
Today you've had a shift to what they call the victimhood culture.
By the way, this is only the third shift that
the
you're
third.
Talking about.
Well, the third that they can trace.
Right, okay.
The third shift is the one to the victimhood culture, in which the institutions of state themselves are seen to be perpetuating the fact that some people are victims on a biological basis, on race, on sexuality, on gender, and that the entire structure of society perpetuates the victimhood of some people on a biological basis. And so there you get this incredible mobilization around racial identity politics.
But isn't that inherently racist and sexist homophobic?
I completely agree. And it comes...
Because you're a priori determining that the reason for someone... You're saying all black people are the same, first of all, which is stereotypical and racist.
All black people are victims.
Right.
All white males, especially if they cishet white males, are members of an oppressive patriarchy.
Yeah.
And you're saying all women are also victims, whether they want to recognize that or not. So biologically, you're putting people into categories, framing their identity, and claiming that you can speak for them.
This is Favut's big dream.
That's exactly. Favut was an identity politician writ large. The state has a right to pigeonhole people into an identity box and determine their rights and their responsibilities.
The state will also decide, as they did during the apartheid era, what rules apply to which race groups and which other groups.
Exactly, and who can say what depending on their group identity, all of that. It is the most retrogressive thing, but it's based on precisely what I was talking about before, the culture of victimhood,
right, so
which is not only a South African culture, it permeates the English-speaking Western world.
We can see it in America.
All the time,
on
that's where it comes from.
And this, it has its roots in... that school of postmodernism.
Well, it has its roots in Marxism, interestingly enough. And I mean, God forbid, would hate to be equated with Marxists. But Marxists look at the entire world through the lens of who's oppressor and who's oppressed. And once there was such advancement...
But he wrote this at a time where there were class structures that no longer exist.
Yes, exactly. That's the point. So in America and in many other Western countries, economic development has gone so against the Marxist trajectory and included so many people in the middle class that the class fault line is not the major fault line of society anymore. So Marxists can't acknowledge that. They have to immediately look for another fault line. And what about the oppression on race? And what about the oppression on gender? And what about the oppression on sexuality? And then that gets lifted up as to the key fault line of society. And everyone who's black then gets lumped into a particular category. And everyone who is white gets lumped into a particular category. And then there are the interminable subcategories of victimhood. So
who's at the top of this pyramid of victimhood?
Well, the most powerful in the pyramid of victimhood is the people who are most intersectionally victimized. So ideally, you should have a race victimization, you should have a gender victimization, you should have a sexuality victimization, and you should have a disability victimization.
And then what? You can say what you say louder than everyone else.
Then you get to be defended and have a right not to be offended.
Yeah.
By anybody in society.
But isn't it also pernicious in that this then treats that person...
Infantilizes them.
They're unable to be challenged, which means that in some way they're excluded from the conversation. I mean,
well, absolutely.
Why would you want to be there?
Well, you see, all of this nonsense is about white people trying to win brownie points from each other. Look how woke I am.
White people trying to do this.
It's actually, wokeness is about whiteness. No, I'm not making this up. The more I look at this mad wokeness, the more I think it's basically white people trying to score status brownie points vis-a-vis each other. Look how enlightened I am.
Is this because they're coddled and they've grown up in a much softer generation that hasn't really had proper challenges and so-called white people's problems?
I think probably, but, you know, I look at what's happening on university campuses and I'm totally amazed at humanities faculties. Fortunately, there are some sensible faculties elsewhere and there are some very, very brave people. I want to talk, for example, about progress at UCT, at Stellenbosch, at other campuses standing up and saying this is bullshit.
Mm.
And they are doing that with very loud voices. And of course, when wokeness becomes the moral high ground position, no one else dare question it without becoming a racist by definition.
Well, they've tried to do this to you on Twitter, which is why we've gone down this rabbit hole of what the philosophy around it is. But you don't seem to care, and that really bothers them. I couldn't care.
You know, the point is, I really don't care. I've got things that I do care about, and worrying about idiots is not one of them.
But then the other argument from some very sensible people, some of them big fans of yours, is, well, why does Helen involve herself with these people?
You know why I do? Because Twitter is a platform, and I use platforms. To run away from a platform is to admit that other people who wanting to curb your free speech have won. And if all the good guys, or all the guys, well, I can't say good or bad, because what's good or bad? We're all searching after the truth, and none of us get to the truth. Debate leads to the truth. So if you abandon the debate, then you're abandoning the very fundamental principle that you believe in, that the dialectic interaction creates progress in society. So just because Twitter enables a whole lot of people to hide behind anonymity and get on and parade their ignorance doesn't mean to say that I'm going to run away from it. And about 5 years ago, Twitter was a completely woke platform. Today, we are building a strong liberal ecosystem on Twitter, and it's really great to see.
Yeah,
the fight is on.
There's some very interesting opinions coming back into that morass, but I'm not persuaded to rejoin it myself. And I understand your argument that you don't abandon the platform because otherwise you've given up the battle.
Yes.
Some battles are not worth fighting.
Well, some battles aren't, but, you know, some battles are. And I love the battle of ideas. And social media is the platform on which the battle of ideas are largely waged today. Radio is another one. Radio is one that won't go out of fashion with digital media because people can listen to it passively while you're cooking. You can't, you know, you can't do Twitter while you're cooking, except that I try and I burn every meal I ever cook. So,
so
you know, I just want to.
Mboweni, you're not going to have a competition for cooking anytime soon.
Absolutely not. My kids used to ask me what I was burning for supper tonight. So, you know, but radio is a great thing because you can just do it passively while doing other things like driving in a car or cooking a meal.
So on that note, you're starting a podcast of your own.
Yes.
Are you going to call it the Helen Ziller Podcast?
I want to really call it something friendly. Because everyone associates me with
being this hardcore politician.
You know, and being vicious and leading people into ambushes and stuff. I'm not that kind of person at all.
Before we even talk about the podcast, can I reflect on this for a minute? Because tomorrow's Women's Day. And, you know, it seems to me almost that there are two standards for women. There are the women that the woke people and that everybody in the commentariat like to refer to as, you know, these strong, independent women. And they look up to like a Beyonce or whatever. But then there are those women who we don't like to associate with. And they try to make those women seem like they're nasty, angry, aggressive bitches who just try to control things. And somehow they're not women anymore. And I think what I'm angling at here is that you've been attacked as a woman by male politicians. You've been attacked on a number of fronts as a person who really should have got a little more leeway as a woman. I feel
Why
like,
should I have?
No, but no one's ever referred to the soft characteristics which you have that are powerful.
Men also have soft characteristics.
Of course.
I mean, no one should give me any allowance for being a woman. I would hate it if they did.
No, but my point is that it seems that those things are thrown out of the window. In fact, they are used against you some
of the time. Of course.
And you are cast as this evil, wicked witch by some people.
Of course.
They forget that you're a mum.
And a granny.
And a granny. And they forget that you're a wife. And they forget that you used to have to burn dinner for your children. And it seems to me almost unfair that you've been put into this situation where you're characterized as this evil Zilla, the Godzilla, right?
Yeah. You know, it's inevitable.
That didn't happen to Winnie.
No. I'll tell you what. You know, Winnie very skillfully, well, Winnie was in large measure a victim, but she very skillfully and very powerfully played that role by fighting back and being uncompromising, but as a victim. People, the woke folk, don't like me because I don't care that I'm a woman. And I don't play on that at all. I don't see myself as disadvantaged for being a woman. And they hate that because that counters the biological narrative. I can understand that in certain circumstances I have had to battle harder as a woman. For example, when I had my children and I wanted to raise them and I wanted to be there for them and I wanted to breastfeed them. And I used to try and battle to get to conferences at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I had little baby vomit on my shoulder, and all the men used to have their clean, crisp, ironed collars. I used to think, well, there is a fundamental challenge biologically because I have to breastfeed and make sure that the baby's happy before I leave and properly looked after, and most of these men have wives doing it for them. You know, that's something that you accept and you work on. And I had a magnificent husband, still do, who always took his responsibilities very seriously. But I don't see myself as an oppressed woman. And they hate that because that counters the narrative. And so they have to paint me as a wicked witch. Of course they do.
Ayanna Presley, who's one of the squad, the four young progressive congresswomen in America, said something interesting the other day. She said, basically, if you don't agree with her political philosophy and you're black, then you're not really black.
Of course.
And if you don't agree with her philosophy and you're gay, you're not really gay.
Mm.
And basically that she is the arbiter of what is acceptable and not. And this seems to me to refer, even tangentially, to what you've just referred to, that you decide whether or not you're a victim in any of these situations. But actually, a lot of people don't want you to make that decision for yourself. They've already made it for you.
Absolutely. You see, and this is the antithesis of freedom. That's why I stand for freedom and for individual choice as to who they are and what opinions they want to have, even if I fundamentally disagree with them. So this lady is very free to have the opinion that if I don't agree with her on feminism, then I'm fundamentally not a woman. But I fundamentally disagree with that and will fight her argument on every platform that I can.
Which is the most feminist position you can take.
Of course it is. But you see, these contradictions are there because people feel that they have found the truth. They have found the truth, and that is an ideology. Now, the good thing about liberalism is that it not only starts from the premise of individual freedom to decide their own identity and who they are, but it also accepts that no individual can ever get right to the truth. We can get close to the truth by questioning and by debating and by disagreeing, but no one can actually get to the truth. Now, the most dangerous thing in society is people who believe they found the truth. So if you don't agree with me, you aren't really black. And if you don't agree with me, you aren't a woman. And if you don't agree with me, you aren't gay, because I know the truth. Well, I want to get your little bullshit emoji and actually put it up here on radio. Because
yeah, just to clear up so that you don't think Helen's gone crazy, we have the poo emoji, which we have on our sofa in the Cliff Central lounge outside.
You see, no one has a monopoly on the truth. And that is why, that's part of the reason why I continue making sure the debate carries on, because if you just leave all these woke heads to Twitter, people start thinking they do have the truth.
All right, but we live in a country where a lot of the time we're told to believe things that just aren't true, particularly by politicians and by rhetoricians and people who just have lots to say and don't necessarily do very much. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that the truth has a power to come out on its own, and that it is, because there are some things that are undeniably true. I mean, if, for example, something happens, and there were issues in your last book that I remember you dealing with, on the basis that eventually the truth comes out.
That's true.
And eventually there is an accounting for every person.
Yes.
Do you think that is true even in a country like this?
I believe that progress over the millennia actually leads us closer to the truth. I do believe that the arc of the universe bends slowly, but it bends towards justice, as Martin Luther King so beautifully said. So I do believe that that's the process, but it takes unbelievable hard work to try and bend that arc of the universe towards the truth, and it takes a very, very long time. So we might not see it in my lifetime. Who cares? As long as I did my bending, my little bit of bending in the time that I was around. And so I believe with Jannie Stadler, who had this brilliant insight so many years ago, that South Africa one day will be governed by liberal principles because it is the only way it can be governed. Now, that doesn't mean to say that many people are going to see that for a very long time, because there's far too much comfort in defaulting to race or defaulting to gender or defaulting to victimhood of one kind or another. There's a huge comfort in doing that. But in the end, we can't work as a society like that. So we have to get a framework of rules that allow maximum individual freedom with accountability and with responsibility towards the whole. And that, I think, will come on the basis of complete non-racialism, of people deciding their own identity, whether it's gay or straight or whatever they want to be, vegetarian or carnivores or whatever they want to be, although there's a big challenge on the carnivore side around the sustainability of the planet, which I'm open to as a debate.
The moral question, I mean, I do think that in perhaps less than 100 years, people will look back on a time when we ate other animals and think, how barbarian.
They will. They probably will. You see, so that is what you call human progress in the debate. Uh-huh. I mean, the debate, I don't like obsessive vegans.
Uh-huh.
And I don't like obsessive vegans imposing their view of the world on other people. But there is certainly an argument to be made for vegetarianism.
Sure. Let's just turn back to you for a second, because I think a lot of people are fascinated in the character of the person. You take on enormous responsibility, even responsibility that isn't yours. But now that you've left office, as a politician and as a member of the party where you had to toe the line, and in certain circumstances, you didn't toe the line and they thought they had a right to call you back in, and you very fundamentally asserted your individual liberties. And a lot of people don't like that. They like to see someone controlled. You're not really controllable.
No, I'm ungovernable, as
they
say. Well,
you are ungovernable, and that's kind of why you had to be leader. you did, and you'll probably end up leader of the IRR as well at some point. No, so look out, France.
I definitely don't want to be.
But I'm curious, want to be a follower. So what's the day-to-day life like now, and how much has changed from that bizarre environment of being a premier of a province?
Yeah. Well, you know, I love my life. You know, I wake up much later now. I don't have to get up at ungodly hours and get up at 4 o'clock to finish articles before I start a day at work and stuff like that. So I really love it. I love being able to get more computer literate. I now know how to read the newspapers online, which I never knew before. It's a new skill I've got. So I love the time to develop new skills. We're staying in another place at the moment, which is always very, very exciting and a new adventure. I've got a new grandson at the moment.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I will say that, who is, you know, they're the light of my life, those children, and I absolutely love them. And I love my spunky little granddaughter who gives me a run for my money. Believe me, she does.
If she's already giving you a run for her money, she must have your money. She must be quite
me.
Something.
She is quite something. All right. And so I've got a great life, and I'm writing, and I'm talking, and I'm traveling. Yeah.
How much do you pay attention to what's still going on in politics?
A lot. I'm still a member of the DA.
Right.
I renewed my membership recently. I'm an ordinary member of the Bloburg branch now.
Okay.
In Cape Town, and I mean, I'm really enjoying that.
And do you hear from your ex-colleagues there all the time?
Some. I have very good friendships in the DA, so I certainly hear from some. Some wish I would biodegrade.
And people across the aisle?
You know, interestingly enough, because I was so strongly pro-ANC in my younger days, I've got a lot of friends across the aisle.
Right.
People that I was often much closer to than I've ever been to people in the DA. When you're working kind of semi-underground with people and mobilizing with people, you build strong bonds. And some of those people like Bonginkosi Madikizela or Albert Fritz and others are now with us, you see. Yeah. So there's a kind of especially deep bond between people like that who've literally had to make sure that they weren't picked up by the police every second day. So that develops quite a strong bond, and I have those bonds still.
Are there people, and you don't have to mention names, although it would make it very funny, that you are glad you never need to see again and you hope never to encounter again?
Oh, no question, no question. And some of them were people who were very close to me but are such opportunists that it's really publicly embarrassing. A guy like that would be Cameron Dugmore.
Ooh. Okay.
You said I should mention
no, go
names,
ahead.
But
I
mean,
like it.
You know, look at him. He went into hiding in my house when he was running away from the police, and he has done absolutely every single devious thing he can to bring me down. You know, when I had the post-matric dance at Rondebosch Boys High, I've got a foster child who was at Rondebosch Boys High, Tkulumang Mputing, and they asked if they could have the post-matric dance at my house. Cameron's own daughter was there partnering a boy, and he did his best behind the scenes to pump up as much flack in the neighborhood for the noise that they caused in late into the night.
You're joking.
Yeah, I'm not joking. I mean, it's bizarre. This kind of completely vile... What can I call it? Hypocrisy is the word. I'm absolutely allergic to hypocrisy.
So what do they want you to do at the IRR?
They want me to fight the battle of ideas.
Okay.
And I can do that in any way I like. And I'm going to be fighting the battle of ideas, not by trying to be vicious or putting other people down like I've just done to Cameron, but he deserves it. He's one of the exceptions who really deserve it.
Okay.
Trying to destroy me and trying to destroy my children especially, which really, really gets to me.
That's not a great place to hit below the belt, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can't get more below the belt than that. So the bottom line is this, that... I'm going to be fighting for those ideas and having the conversations. I'll be traveling around the country, I hope to the most remote areas, promoting the ideas of an open society, a free society, a liberal society, a society where we're trying to find the answers and where no one ideologically has got them. Honesty, accountability, all of the things we've been talking about. Yes, that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be writing a lot to do that. I hope I'll get enough time to write another book because I really want to advance this idea that this is the only way South Africa can eventually be governed. And I'm going to be talking to a lot of prominent people, I hope.
That sounds terrific. So the Helen Ziller podcast, it'll have its own name.
Yes, I think I'm going to choose a very, very unthreatening name. Because
okay.
People think, you know, I'm not going to call it Godzilla or anything like that. Because that would be a bit terrifying to people, you know, see a dinosaur stomping all over them. No.
Well, that's a lot of people thought that's what you were while you were in active politics.
No, well, you see, actually, the people who coined that name for me were my sons when they were teenagers. And I used to get unbelievably strict with them sometimes because, believe me, they deserved it. They deserved some whipping into line, as teenage boys do.
Yeah.
And they called me Godzilla.
But it stuck.
Yeah, it stuck. But it won't, you know, I think I love the idea that's been made to me by Roman, which is tea with Helen.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a nice idea.
Well,
sounds completely mild, doesn't it?
I still want
fireside chat.
And maybe this could be the launch of it, because I'd like to host that tea that you and Tuli had together.
Yeah.
And have the two of you just talk it over with an actual cup of tea in the studio, and you can take that as your first episode and then get going with the rest.
Well, you know, certainly we have an episode with Tuli on the cards.
Good.
And I get on very well with Tuli. We disagree on many things. I mean, she believes in the politics of identity.
Mm-hmm.
She strongly believes in identity-based restitution. I believe in reparations, absolutely, and restitution. But I believe that it needs to be based on objective criteria. And she will, you know, so we disagree on many, many things, but we're civil about it.
Yeah.
And that is what I'd like the platform to be. Civil, interactive agreement and disagreement.
Lovely.
And I don't actually believe that debating champions, and I won't put any names to that, should be radio talk show hosts, because they don't believe in discussion. They believe in winning every debate and putting everybody down. And I'm not going to be doing that, no, except for Cameron Dugmore.
Don't worry. I mean, anyone, yeah, you've reserved a special place in your own personal hell for him, haven't
you? Yes, and there is a special place reserved for him, believe
me. But people aren't listening to radio like they use. Not the people who actually make a difference. Podcasting's the way to go, Helen.
Yeah, no. And alternative media is the way to go. Sure. There's no question about it. And it's becoming bigger and bigger, including, thank goodness, on university campuses.
Yeah, there's some interesting things that are starting to develop there. So I wish you luck. I think it's terrific that you're still part of the public discourse, and I'm delighted to hear it, because I think it would have been a great loss if we'd lost one of the people who still stands up for what she believes in. There are too many people who are flaky and will say whatever is popular. And then there are people who have good ideas, and there are people who have bad ideas, and we need to hear them stand up and say their say as well.
Exactly. Everyone must have the courage to say their say and to listen to alternative arguments and concede when they need to develop a new argument because theirs has failed.
Right. There we are. It's good ideas and bad ideas. Helen Ziller, thank you very much. It's nice to see you again. I hope this won't be the last time we talk for a while, because the last time I saw you was, 2-3 years ago. So let's try and keep this up.
But more regularly. Yeah. Great.
Helen Ziller, it is just about 9 o'clock.
This is CliffCentral.com.